Hello, my name is Bob Bamber, and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're going back in the time machine to July of 1994. We'll start with news of the steroid trial and that Vince McMahon and Titan Sports were found not guilty on all charges related to it. What will now follow is a pre-written script read by me reviewing the steroid trial in full. We will then continue with the rest of the show like usual and our Bash at the Beach review. Vince McMahon and Titan Sports were found not guilty on all charges relating to conspiracy and distribution in the steroid trial this month. Two of the three charges, both relating to possession with intent to distribute steroids to Terry Bollea, Hulk Hogan, were dropped due to a lack of evidence. Without the testimony of the limo driver, Ann Bollea, one of the key prosecution witnesses, denying the evidence ever took place, there wasn't anything to prove that either incident had happened. The part about conspiracy hinged on definition. The idea of steroid use was never in doubt, and evidence provided by nearly all of the relevant witnesses proved likely beyond reasonable doubt that McMahon and Titan Sports were aware of what was going on, and may have even in places encouraged it. But proving a conspiracy was beyond them. The government had to prove that McMahon and Titan Sports, who were treated as the same entity as McMahon is the sole owner, knowingly, willfully, and lawfully joined a conspiracy. Having knowledge of illegal activity is not a conspiracy, neither is failing to stop it. This is the full story of the 1994 WWF steroid trial. On November the 18th, 1993, Vince McMahon and Titan Sports were indicted by the United States Department of Justice on five counts of illegal activity related to anabolic steroids for the period between 1985 and 1991. Charges for the indictment saw this drop from five charges to three. Count number one, which fractures into four separate charges, alleges that Vince McMahon conspired to defraud the United States government. These four charges were as follows. Number one, defrauding the DFA in its attempts to regulate steroids. Number two, introducing into commerce steroids which were distributed in a way that prescription drugs shouldn't be. Number three, causing steroids to be distributed in ways which prescription drugs shouldn't be. Number four, knowingly possessing with intent to distribute and distributing steroids for purposes other than treatment of disease in humans. The other two accounts allege that Vince McMahon and Titan Sports possessed steroids with intent to distribute to Terry Bollea, better known as Hulk Hogan, on April the 13th, 1989 and October the 24th, 1989. Originally, there were five charges. Numbers two through five were essentially an expanded version of the final two. But with Vince McMahon and Titan Sports dealt with as separate entities, given that McMahon is the sole owner of Titan Sports, it was decided that this did not apply. The trial surrounded a number of key witnesses, all called by the prosecution. Oddly, neither Vince McMahon nor the limo driver that would likely have been the key man in tying up distribution charges were called up. The first part of the trial surrounded Dr. George Zahorian, who was convicted a few years earlier himself of distributing steroids in 1990. Zahorian was the doctor backstage at TV tapings in the 80s that happened in Hershey, Pennsylvania. In 1989, a law change required that all doctors backstage had to be from an approved list that meant Zahorian could no longer be officially in the building. Zahorian would set up a stand at events in Hershey, and wrestlers would line up and collect either a brown bag or a Federal Express package. Zahorian would testify that there was no way anyone could have known the exact contents of the packages. Dave Meltzer said of Zahorian that he, quote, displayed numerous symptoms of being an obsessed fan in the white coat. Jim Helwig, better known as the Ultimate Warrior, said, he'd take your blood pressure, check your eyes and ears, and ask how you were doing, and then ask if there was anything you needed. Anita Scales, a WWE office worker, said that another road agent told her that Zahorian's bag was often so heavy that he would have to roll it into the building. Zahorian's role in the prosecution case surrounded trying to prove that there was a conspiracy between him and McMahon. The evidence in this regard wasn't all that forthcoming. The pair rarely spoke, and it is said that McMahon was rarely, if ever, in and around the same part of the building where Zahorian would be set up. Zahorian was asked if he was ever encouraged by anyone at Titan Sports to make wrestlers bigger than life so that they'd have a better product to sell to the public. Zahorian said no. What was interesting was that while there wasn't much directly connecting McMahon with Zahorian, many of the wrestlers seemed to want Zahorian around. Multiple wrestlers who stood trial testified a concern about getting fake or black market steroids, and the perception was that Zahorian provided a safe way of getting the real product. One of the key parts of this was the change in the ruling in 1989. Pennsylvania deregulated wrestling, so while a doctor had to appear, Zahorian was no longer assigned to the tapings. They required a physician to be in attendance, but put the promotion in charge of hiring him for a commission-approved list, and that the promoter must pay him. Anita Scales, who works at Titan, was responsible for hiring a doctor for the shows in Hershey. She didn't want Tahorian because she knew of his reputation and thought that made him bad news. She said, quote, "Pat Patterson called and said he wanted Tahorian to work Hershey. I said assignments were done. He said the boys wanted him. I said that was too bad." End quote. The memo that the prosecution believed to be the smoking gun of the case was sent by Linda McMahon to Pat Patterson in December of 1989, telling Patterson to warn Tahorian about the investigation and that they needed to cut ties with him, mentioning steroids in the category of illegal drugs. Again, the idea that higher-ups weren't fully aware of what was going on is highly improbable, but that wasn't what the trial was trying to ascertain. Both charges of distribution were actually dropped by the judge, citing a lack of evidence. The April the 13th charge didn't really have anything to go on, and Terry Bollea said he never received steroids sent by McMahon at the National Coliseum in the October one. The government never really got to the point of detail on either of those two cases. The only October show that took place at the Coliseum happened 4 days before Emily Feinberg, a WWF worker who was another big witness on the case, received the package from Tahorian, and the alleged event took place. Bollea's testimony, which was one of the one that easily drew the most media attention, was meant to be the star witness for the government, but its testimony did anything but. Bollea said he began using steroids in 1976 and said that steroid use in the WWF was very common at the time. He agreed with the statement that Titan had nothing to do with wrestlers being provided with steroids from Tahorian. Another WWF office worker who worked very closely with Ms. McMahon was Emily Feinberg. She said that in June of 1988, Vince called her and asked her to send a check to Tahorian, but to make sure it wasn't a company check. She testified that she was asked to provide steroids to Hulk Hogan. Quote, "A shipment arrived from Tahorian. He, Mr. McMahon, dumped the package on his desk, separated some of them, and asked me to get them to the driver who would give them to Hulk at the local building, MSG, the Meadowlands, or Nassau Coliseum." She said that this occurred more than once. She said Vince McMahon began using steroids with Hulk Hogan when Vince was producing the movie No Holds Barred in Atlanta. She said Vince said he had started using steroids with Hogan that summer. So where was Vince McMahon in all this? There's plenty of testimony and insinuation that McMahon wanted wrestlers to, quote, have the look. Rick Rude testified that McMahon once told him he, quote, didn't look good. Rude said he was trying to establish a family, but McMahon told him to, quote, push himself. Rude said he understood that to mean that he should be taking something, e.g. steroids. How much McMahon fully knew about what was going on is hard to tell, especially as he never testified, but it is probable that he knew quite a lot. Tahorian said that he was told by McMahon to, quote, keep wrestlers more healthy, end quote, by providing them with genuine steroids. Tahorian said that he told McMahon, quote, if you want me to stop, let me know and I will stop what I am doing, end quote. So what were steroids at the time then? The truth is, really, that most wrestlers were on them, unless your side didn't illicit them for one reason or another. This started years before Vince McMahon Jr. took charge of the company. Tom Zenk described steroids like, quote, fertilizing a lawn, end quote, giving him energy, a better physique, and a better recovery rate from injuries. He said that he weighed 195 pounds before taking steroids, and now weighed 305 pounds. It was said that after the not guilty verdict was announced that the courtroom, quote, exploded, Vince McMahon afterwards said, quote, "I didn't have a great deal of faith in the judicial system, but I had an overwhelming faith in humanity." He later added, "I was singled out unfairly. I had everything riding on this case. I'd be less than candid to say I wasn't nervous. I was definitely nervous," end quote. On Hogan's testimony, he said, "I don't feel bad that anyone tells the truth. However, it feels bad when someone you work with takes the stand and does not tell the whole truth and all of the truth. That hurt me very badly," end quote. Now, on to the rest of the show. Del Muir. Del, how are you?
Hi, Bob.
And a debut for Chris Lacey. Chris, good evening.
Afternoon.
Del kicks off with the news.
Starting with WCW this month, Bob Hulk Hogan won the World Heavyweight Championship from Ric Flair at the Bash of the Beach pay-per-view. The event took place on July 17th in front of a hot crowd in Orlando, Florida. The main event saw great reaction for both Hogan and Flair, and saw Hulk flanked by manager Jimmy Hart and the A-Team's Mr. T. Hogan would later be presented the title by NBA star Shaquille O'Neal. The match itself was won in a clean and decisive manner. Hogan even imitated Flair during the match with the figure four leg lock and the famous Flair strut. Unsurprisingly, the match ended with Hogan hulking up, hitting the big boot and the leg drop for the victory.
Jim Ross has re-signed with the WWF. Jim Ross only recently left the WWF a short time ago, but he's already returned to TV with the company, albeit with a short-time role covering Vince McMahon, who's clearly had more important things to do this month. And Gorilla Monsoon with the company were unhappy with his lead announcing. Jim Ross is still suffering with facial paralysis, suffering a bout of Bell's palsy in February.
And back at WCW, while the main event dominated the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view, the show also saw a further title change and a significant heel turn. Pretty Wonderful, the team of Paul Orndorff and Paul Roma, defeated Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan to win the WCW World Tag Team titles. Also in the other tag match facing Bunkhouse Buck and Terry Funk against Arn Anderson and Dustin Rhodes, Anderson turned heel on Rhodes at the end of the match, joining Colonel Robert Parker's quickly expanding stable.
And SummerSlam is shaping up. While the story that will lead to the match is yet to be fully told on TV, the WWF have already announced that the main event for SummerSlam will be The Undertaker versus The Undertaker. Surprisingly, perhaps, given that this week on TV, the match was announced, Paul Bearer was still acting like the fake Undertaker was the real Undertaker, trying to turn him back to the good side. The co-main event will see a rematch from WrestleMania with Bret Hart versus Owen Hart in a steel cage for the WWF title.
And that will wrap up the news for this month. Now, into the review of WCW Bash of the Beach. Del, the results.
Lord Steven Regal defeated Johnny B. Badd to retain the WCW World Television Championship. Vader defeated the Guardian Angel by disqualification. Terry Funk and Bunkhouse Buck defeated Dustin Rhodes and Arn Anderson. Steve Austin defeated Ricky Steamboat to retain the WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. Pretty Wonderful, Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff defeated Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan to win the WCW World Tag Team Championships, and the main event saw Hulk Hogan defeat Ric Flair and is now your new WCW World Heavyweight Champion.
Chris, your overall thoughts on the show?
It's a very, very solid show. The one thing that did get me was there was a lot of outside shenanigans at the end of matches that they could have done without. But as an overall, it was a solid show. There was some really good wrestling matches. The Steamboat and Austin match was a clinic. The opener was a solid wrestling match as well. And surprisingly, Flair and Hogan delivered, when I was going into it, I was thinking, after the stories coming out of pre-WrestleMania 8, of the house show run that they did, that the matches were terrible, to see them do it on the big stage on pay-per-view was... It shows that WF may have missed a trick.
No.
Pretty much agree with Chris there, Bob. The main event really delivered for me. They built it up for what seemed like months, but actually a matter of maybe 46 weeks with the main event. Steamboat again in Austin was a pretty solid outfit. You know what I'm like with William Regal. I loved seeing Steven Regal, him being the opener was a good one. I thought it was a pretty solid show. The only worry for me was the clash that we reviewed last month. I think we've seen 5 matches over 90 minutes. This one we've seen 6 and it was double the length of time. But the few matches interspersed for the beginning to the end with Austin Steamboat in the middle, I thought they pulled it off.
Yeah, I mean, this was a one-match show, and the one match delivered. And it was a one-match show so much to the point that the previous 6 or 5 that preceded it all ended with the heels winning and invariably by DQ. Sting never showed up. He was written off the week before with a storyline injury. Dusty Rhodes, didn't show up in Florida where he would have got a massive pop. It would set up for the main event. And the main event was great. And that was it. I mean, it was, we'll come to it when we get to it, so I won't go into that in too much depth. But I kind of go back to where I was with Starrcade back in December last year. It's like, well, with a show like this, it's a one-match show. If the one match is good, it's a really good show. If the one match isn't good, it's a really bad show. And the main event was very good. We will start with Lord Stephen Regal defeating Johnny B. Bad. We kind of had a lot of arm tie-ups early on. The crowd were kind of disinterested and did a lot of USA chants. Confetti all over the ring. Johnny B. Bad shooting off his confetti gun before the start of the match. Regal went outside to look to settle an injury. Went to leave the arena at one point, but decided against it. Tried again second time later in the match, discussing with Sir William, but Johnny B. Bad did a splash to the outside, which the camera barely picked up. Then we got to a finish. We had Lord Stephen Regal kind of went to do his finish we saw a couple of months ago. He went to sit down on the sunset flip, and he grabbed Sir William's cane. The ref again kicked it. Johnny B. Bad reversed it into his own pin. Regal reversed it into his own pin. Finish was a bit soft. Regal never really looked to have that pin fully latched in. The ref kind of didn't do a very good count, so the crowd missed it. All in all, it was an okay opener. Chris, is that fair to say?
It was solid. There was some good solid wrestling in it. It was massively sort of spoiled by the sloppy finish, though. I mean that really did sort of put up a bit of a downer on.
Do you mean the finish, the concept, or the execution?
The execution of it. I expect better from Regal, if I'm being honest. Seeing his work for as long as we have, and knowing how good he is, it's one of those of I did expect him to, do it better and it to look cleaner.
No.
But other than that, I thought it was great.
Yeah, just again with the ending, Bob, just a wee bit awkward. As you say, kind of similar to what we've seen in recent months with the involvement of Sir William at the end up. As I say, it was just a bit awkward with the roll up for Regal for the end, but the actual match kind of take away for an opening contest. As you say, it's a one match pay-per-view. Nobody's bought a ticket there, I say, for Regal and Bad, but it was as good an opener as you would see. Some strong wrestling for Regal. Kind of flashing back even at times to the World of Sport stuff with Johnny Saint, with the kind of try to, like, an escapism style. It was good to see a young guy like Regal kind of bringing that style to a modern generation. Good match. Kind of awkward at the end, but overall I think it's a decent opener.
While it's on my mind, this was going to be the match Sting was going to be in. He was going to be in the opener with Regal, but clearly for one reason or another they decided against that because he's not injured. They wrote him out on TV the week or so before, but no, he's fine. Yeah, it was an okay match. It never really grabbed my attention, and it was kind of, we've seen this match from Regal a lot of times before, and it's kind of, we fall back into the pattern of him having decent action, some okay crowd heat, with a sloppy or nefarious finish at the end. It was fine. Then Mean Gene Oakland came out and introduced Antonio Inoki, presented Inoki with a plaque, and he said, "I present you with a plaque and a quote, a standing ovation." I never heard someone preempt a standing ovation by saying it, which I thought was quite good, for his contributions to wrestling. So Regal, who hadn't quite left at this point, stepped back into the ring and cut what I thought was a pretty good promo. So much so, we're going to debut a new feature on the show. We're actually going to listen to it. So, well, here it is.
Am I led to believe, my eyes here, that this man from overseas is receiving a plaque for being an honourable wrestler, when a noble Englishman like myself, who's been elected into the House of Lords and has beat everybody that you have to offer, doesn't get an award? Am I led to believe right?
You'll have your day someday, Regal.
I put an end to one legend in this country, and now you have to fly legends, supposed legends, in. I've just come back from Tokyo, where I defeated each and every one of the supposed great stars in Japan. I didn't see this man anywhere to be found.
Are you kidding me? He is a legend in Japan and all over the world.
Listen, beating Muhammad Ali, beating the late great Andre the Giant doesn't wear with me. I'm far superior to you, and it's a bloody good job you're retired right now. Else, I'd have to give you a lesson just like I give Zabisco one.
Chris, what do you think of Regal's promo and the segment as a whole?
I really like it. I like the way that he comes across as snooty in English and, you know, why aren't you giving me a plaque? I deserve it better. He's done it before recently, and it's just one of those that I think it builds his character so well, and it fits him so well. It's really good use of Regal.
No.
Oh, he's our villain, isn't he, Bob? That boy. Kind of interested to see where it goes. The kind of two reasons that I could think for having Inoki there, is it a case where they're maybe going to have Regal v Inoki in the next couple of months? I know Inoki's getting on a bit. Or is it maybe something where they're maybe looking to reopen the kind of partnership with American and Japanese wrestling, maybe going to try and kind of set up a partnership with what Inoki's got going over in Japan to get some young Japanese guys over. I'm interested to see where it goes.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really good. And his promo work, if he can cut promos like that, he's going to go a long way. I think that's fair to say. Moving on to the second match of the night, Vader versus the Guardian Angel. Before the match even started, Harley Race kind of got in the Guardian Angel's face. Guardian Angel went after Race, but Vader pounced on the distraction. At one point we got a nice submission move by Vader where he went for kind of a leg lock, lying down, and then at one point modified it almost into an STF move. Then at one point Vader hit a Vader bomb followed by a Vader soul. I thought the Guardian Angel actually popped up quite quickly from this following it, as a response to Ray's climb to the top rope, as he always seemed to do, to go for the diving headbutt. Ray's handed Vader a nightstick. Vader doesn't get the chance to use it. But the Guardian Angel picks him up after knocking Vader down. The ref sees him with it and they accuse him. Del, these two had a war at Spring Stampede about three months ago. This wasn't that. They never gave it the chance to be that either, so it's not like it's a critique of either of the guys. But I just thought an odd matchup. They didn't want Guardian Angel to lose because it's his second match in that guise, obviously formerly the boss. And Vader, who you would think will be feuding with Hogan at some point in the near future, the kid didn't want him to lose either. All in all, just a really perplexing matchup and an unsurprisingly a very soft finish.
Pretty much, it seemed to be with position, with timing, it just seemed to be there to make up the numbers, Bob, which is it's a bit of a shame considering the two guys that you've got in there. I mean, there was some good stuff in the match. We don't want to take away from the fact that these two guys, for their size, are still pretty decent hands. Obviously, the Guardian Angel still trying to kind of find his feet with the character that's been somewhat forced upon him. Vader, for a big guy, is still as good as the things that he does as anybody else, whether it's the diving sunset flip for the top rope that was just lovely to watch for a guy his size. The moonsault he can still do as good as anybody. Couple of kind of strange things in the match. I thought there was a spot with the mask getting taken off Vader that seemed a bit throwaway, kind of literally because the Guardian Angel then threw it at Harley Race, but it seemed a bit of a waste of a spot where he could maybe have used that down the line in a mask match or a mask versus hair or something like that. It seemed a bit strange and perplexing from a booking point of view. The end, as you say, was anything but definitive, but as I say, not to take away from the match, there was still some good stuff in there, especially the stuff with Vader that I've mentioned, but even the Angel doing the superplex from a suplex over the ropes from the apron, the scoop slam on Vader holding the big man up for a good 5, maybe 10 seconds. Decent enough match, just a bit of a shame with the timing and the positioning for me.
Chris.
To me, it was a good, solid, sort of big man slugfest. You know, two hard-hitting guys hitting each other really hard. It leaves it open to continue if they want to keep going with the feud. I'm still always in awe of Vader doing the moonsault because someone his size shouldn't do those sort of things. I liked how they used Harley Race in the match. It was a good use of the manager to sort of further the match along and sort of keep spots going to sort of not make it completely, you know, stand still at times.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said a minute ago, we've seen these guys have a war, and this certainly wasn't that, and it wasn't designed to be that. But it was decent action given the time they were given and given the kind of format they were given. But I kind of feel both of these guys would be better off in different programs right now because they don't want either guy to lose, which is fair enough. But just don't put them in the match. Backstage we have Mike Tenay and, doing some hotline work. Terry Funk walks past him and mouths something off. Then we had the preview video to the match. Well, preview video was very good actually. Arn Anderson, Dustin Rhodes versus Bunkhouse Buck and Terry Funk with Colonel Robert Parker. This match ended when Arn Anderson turned heel on Dustin Rhodes. Rhodes was involved for all bar the first 30 and the last 15 seconds of the match. So a lot of kind of two-on-one, kind of building heel heat with the heel guys. Terry Funk's great. I could say that every month. Bunkhouse Buck, I think, is delivering as well. So at one point, Rhodes was firing them two-on-one. The crowd went with him, which was really good. That happened for a number of minutes, and then he finally gets the hot tag to Anderson, who basically jumps in the ring and immediately hits a DDT. That was a surprise. I mean, I think we knew Anderson was going to turn heel on him at some point, but I didn't think it was going to be tonight. And then obviously, the heel team won the match. Chris, I thought this was easily the best match of the night so far. Really good action. Funk's fantastic. Rhodes played a very good babyface in peril, and I get the sense that a lot of people didn't see that heel turn coming.
See, I'm going to play devil advocate here. I didn't like the match. I thought it dragged. It didn't do anything for me. It was one of those of... It served its purpose for the end, where Anderson turned... I'd have liked to have seen the DDT that he did first time around and not have to wait for the replay, because the camera work was a bit shoddy at the end, but it just doesn't do anything for me. I think it might be because I don't really like Bunkhouse Buck, Funk, or Dustin. I just don't like their styles. It doesn't entertain me. I could see what it was there for, but it just didn't do anything for me.
No.
Seeing you don't like it, Bob, Chris. Well, Bob, you do like it, Chris. You don't. I'll stick in the middle. I thought it was decent. Some kind of really good what.
I didn't love it for what that's worth. I thought it was good action. Sorry, carry on.
That's all right. It was decent. It done what it was meant to do. It was never there to get the crowds in. It wasn't as bad as some of the recent tag team matches that we've seen. I thought it served a purpose, and there was some really good work with young Dustin Rhodes playing the victim, as you say, with the two guys for Colonel Parker's stable, kind of working them over. There was some good cheating in the middle, kind of building up the crowd. The crowd, kind of so far tonight, obviously waiting for the main event, there have been some quiet spells, but they did respond to what was happening in the ring. There was some good spots with Dustin kind of doing a bit of an homage to his dad with the bionic elbows in the middle. He's never going to have the charisma, he's old man, but he did kind of get the crowd on side for that. Again, the turn at the end, I think we all kind of thought it would come at some point, but as you say, the first match out, a couple of lock-ups at the start, don't see Arn Anderson again, and he's turned on young Dustin Rhodes right at the end of the match. I don't think any has seen it coming that quick, so it's kind of good to get a bit of kind of good spotlight on Dustin Rhodes. It's just where he takes it from here.
Yeah, I mean, I do find it quite difficult not to enjoy any match that Terry Funk is in. So that's part of it. But I thought they told a really nice story. It was one of those things where they didn't preempt it. They didn't try and build it. It was just a snap surprise. And I think most people would have gone with it.
Yeah, looking back, especially when you look at what they've actually managed to pull off. I mean, I'm not sure of the time. You'll probably be able to correct me, Bob, but I'd imagine that went 12 to 15 minutes in there.
Just over plus, 11 for what that's
just
worth.
Just over 11. Dustin Rhodes was in there, his cell. You've got Arn Anderson, who obviously is trying to kayfabe pump up the crowd and get them on Dustin's side. You've then got the crowd that's going to be thinking possibly, why don't you tag in Arn Anderson? Actually been able to get away with that for the best part of kind of 10 and a half, 10 and three quarter minutes before the turn for Anderson. It's a pretty impressive job that I've been able to pull that off with the two guys with Funk and Buck working over Dustin Rhodes, and then for that still to come out of left field. It's pretty impressive stuff, really, when you think about it.
After the match, Mean Gene Oakland tried to catch a word with the Morgan to the back. Anderson simply said, back to the party, as he invited him, presumably backstage for some celebrations. Then we got an interview with Hank Aaron, who said he's pulling for, quote-unquote, both of them in the main event.
All right, Tony Schiavone, I'm with Censure with Sherry, and the WCW Heavyweight Champion of the World with a big smile, a big grin on his face, Ric Flair.
How about Double A? How about it? Is he back? I guess he is! Dustin Rhodes, what you gonna do when Double A runs wild on you?
You've got other things to contemplate tonight. The biggest match of your career, Ric Flair, there is no doubt about it. Standing by on the wings to challenge you for this title is none other than Hulk Hogan.
I walk in the door. They said, Nature Boy, S.I.O., standing room only to see Hogan and Flair go at it for this. I said, boys, that's just the way the Hulkster and the Nature Boy want it. We want it sold out. We want it live. We want it worldwide. Dignitaries from all points of the world are here. And Noki, Hank Aaron, Hammerhead Hank, Big Shaquille O'Neal, they're all here. But you know why? Because the greatest of all time is going to walk that aisle. And tonight, the immortal one becomes history, right, the just one.
That's right, Gene Oakland. For years and years, you've been saying to be the man, you've got to beat the man. Ric Flair is always the man. Ric Flair has nothing to prove. You, Hulk Hogan, are the challenger. You, Hulk Hogan, are the one that has a failing career. You, Hulk Hogan, have to beat the man to be the man.
We are living the rock. Kiss stealing, wheeling dealers, winners and champions of the WCW. Woo!
Thank you very much, Ric Flair, champion. And a very lovely Censure with Sherry. Let's get back to ringside.
Moving on to the US title match, Ricky Steamboat versus Stunning Steve Austin. Steve Austin feigned a knee injury early in the match, went for a low blow. One point in the match, Austin picked up Steamboat, slammed him on his back, and the crowd oohed for that. Steamboat then hit a flying axe handle, then went for a 10 punch, which fired at the crowd. One point later in the match, Austin set up for his own tombstone pile driver, but Steamboat countered into one of his own. Steamboat went for a top rope crossbody, but Austin kind of threw the referee into the line of fire. The referee didn't actually get hit, but the referee wanted to disqualify Austin. Steamboat actually went to the referee and said, no, I want the match to continue. Austin rolled through for a cover and then used the ropes for leverage to get the three count. Dale, your thoughts on this match?
Some pretty entertaining stuff, actually, Bob. Since Stunning Steve's obviously left Colonel Parker, behind Colonel Parker's obviously going to expand his stable with the likes of potentially Arn Anderson joining that tonight. It's nice to see Steve Austin out on his own for a change, and it seems that he's actually quite entertaining when he wants to be. There's the bit in the middle where he feigns the leg injury, as you say, and then also feigns a bit of an arm injury, batters Steamboat round the melt with the arm, then says to the crowd that's quite quiet, yep, I think the arm's feeling a bit better. There's the spot where he's got Steamboat in the ropes out for the count, then takes Steamboat's arm, waves to the camera that's right in his face and says hello to the TV audience. It seems as if Steve Austin could actually be quite entertaining. Hopefully we see a bit more of that where I'm kind of going solo now.
Chris?
To me, it was the best match of the night. The pace was frantic at times, slowed down. It flowed, it was back and forth. Both guys put everything they had into it, and it just was solid. It was amazing storytelling. As I said, even the finish where, you know, Dragon went with the crossbody and he just rolled through and then hooked the legs, it gives him the cheating style win of a heel. You know, it fit the character of Stunning Steve. I just thought that by far it was the match of the night.
Yeah, I didn't go with this quite like you two did. I've never been a massive fan of Steamboat style of wrestling anyway. If it's a bit too kind of floaty and soft, and don't get me wrong, I can appreciate the art and I can appreciate other people liked it, but I just never tremendously got into the match. I admired it at times, but I never really felt kind of into it. I mean, Austin did some good stuff. But no, this match for me was okay, and it was probably better than the majority of stuff that came before it, but it wasn't anything overly special. And yeah, Austin escapes with the title, as he probably should have done. And I would like to see more of him, but I don't know whether Steamboat's the right opponent for that. But anyway, move on. We had a pretty wonderful backstage. Then Mean Gene crashed the Funk Bunk Buck and Anderson party. Anderson reflected back on his Clash promo, said that when he'd get the old Anderson, that's what he meant. He otherwise didn't justify his actions. Then, tag team titles. Pretty Wonderful defeated the team of Kevin Sullivan and Cactus Jack to win the WCW Tag Team Championships. Focus on Sullivan and Jack showing good teamwork early on. There's a nice spot where Sullivan did double headbutts from both opponents on the same turnbuckle pad, which is quite cool. At one point, Dave Sullivan interfered for the babyface team, which is a bit weird. And then we got this finish. Oh, this is odd. Cactus Jack goes for his DDT, I think, on Paul Orndorff. And then as he went down, Paul Roma kind of grabbed to his legs as Jack went to baseball slide him. Roma grabbed his legs and Orndorff covered him. And the ref, despite seeing all this and seeing Roma having his legs grabbed and meaning that Jack in theory couldn't kick out because he had no leverage on his legs, the ref still counted it. And we have new tag team champions. Del, I didn't like this match. We've seen some really good stuff from Kevin Sullivan and Cactus Jack, but apparently WCW have a remit now where they're toning down the violence a lot. And if they are, they're in a bit of trouble with, well, maybe that explains the title change, because this was not a good match.
Yeah, it is a thing where you're wondering to yourself, it is something that they've actively spoke to Cactus and Sullivan about. The title change, I wasn't a great fan of it, but if it is a case where the company's maybe looking at the direction of a Sullivan and Cactus title run in a match style that they've got, you've got to think the title change maybe is for the best, even during the match. Going back to last month, there was Cactus with the springboard to the outside and the flat back bump that was pretty unnecessary. But if you look at this month, there was a spot ideally made up for him with the flying elbow off the apron to the outside that he didn't go for. He just went down the stairs. So it might be a case where they're maybe looking to get away from that style and get back to the in-ring stuff, which obviously isn't Sullivan and Cactus's strong point. But it wasn't a great match. The main concern for me, apart from Kelvin Sullivan's tights, which seem to get smaller by the month, it seems like it was three out of the four wrestlers in that fight wouldn't look out of place in a 1980 show. We're talking 1994 now. And it's a pretty sad state of affairs to get into when you're relying on Cactus Jack to bring a bit of speed and momentum to the match. So it wasn't a strong point of the night for me, but as you say, if it gets the titles onto a new team, they've got the makings of a strong heel unit there. Obviously, Mr. Wonderful's been the bad guy for how many years now? Paul Roma looks good alongside them. They've got a good look. We'll just need to see where they take it from here.
Chris?
It was too long, I thought. It was slow, it was tedious. There was too much rest holds. Obviously, with as you were saying, with WCW looking to maybe cull the extreme side of it, has really hampered what Sullivan and Foley could actually do. Cactus really wasn't doing a lot. It just sort of dragged, and it didn't need as long as it had.
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, the last three matches were all 20 minutes long. And so as much as that's balanced, that's this match being as long as the main event. And yeah, I think you're right. It didn't warrant it that Cactus Jack, I don't know whether Cactus Jack can tell a story good enough to prop up the other three in a match where he can't do anything. And I'm not sure Orndorff these days is much of anything. I'm not sure Roma has ever been much of anything. I quite like Kevin Sullivan, but again, he's on Cactus Jack's team. As you said, the title change makes sense, but you know, it was nothing of anything, and it was a real, probably the low note of the show, I would say this. This is one of those where, and maybe it was by design. Maybe they thought, let's put a real snoozer in before the main event. Let's give these guys 20 minutes and let them really settle the crowd down so they're really relaxed in the main event. Maybe there's that, although I might want to just give them way more credit than they deserve. But there was that. So we will move on to the main event. Tony Schiavone called the Hogan Flair match the quote unquote the greatest match in the history of professional wrestling. We start by having Shaquille O'Neal being introduced, massive ovation, terrible sideburns. We then had Flair got a big pop, Hogan accompanied by Jimmy Hart and Mr. T got a bigger pop. Michael Buffer likened this match to quote unquote Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. I don't know whether he meant them being on the moon or a wrestling match that we don't know. But there was that, and then Shaquille O'Neal held the title belt to start the action. Hogan did a flare strut early on, that got a huge reaction. And Hogan, it must said, looks in really good shape. And we've got all the stuff coming up with the steroid trial, and he is probably noticeably in leaner shape, I would say, than he was when we last saw him in the WWF. Hogan dominated the early exchanges, but it's kind of happened a lot in this match. Hogan would get on top, Sherry would get involved, and Hogan would lose the advantage. Flair would get back on top until Hogan kind of got his way back into the match. Sherry went to use a chair at one point. Jimmy Hart stopped her. Massive pop. Hogan hulked up after an apron suplex. Big pop. Hits a big boot, and Flair is only saved when Sherry pulls the referee out of the ring. Hogan inadvertently knocks Sherry off the top rope after hulking up. Does another fair strut and locks in a figure four of his own. Sherry came round and introduced the brass knuckles. Flair nails Hogan with the brass knuckles, but kicks out. There one more hulk up. He did a few in this match. Big boot, leg drop, clean victory. Crowd goes berserk. Del, this was a really good match. Flair, to his credit, did a ton of selling in this match, and this wasn't a match where Hogan got beaten down for 17 or 18 minutes. Hogan was on top for a lot of it, and Flair went with him. I don't want to say he carried him, because Hogan very much contributed his part to this match, but I think this match was about as good as anybody could have expected it to be, and given the scenario, I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, they kind of had that issue coming in, Bob, with the amount of build that this has obviously been getting, whether it's on the signing of Hogan, the press conferences getting made, Billionaire Ted coming out, Tony Schiavone, as you said, saying it's the biggest and the best match in professional wrestling history. They'd a lot to live up to, but to their credit, they managed to do it. I don't quite know how they managed to do it with the countless superfluous adjectives that was used pre-match, but they did manage to do it. I mean, you've got Hogan wrestling in this match, which is a novelty to and of itself. For me, it's Hogan's best match in at least 4 or 5 years. The only thing that I could think of prior to it off the top of my head as I was watching was it harks back to the likes of WrestleMania 6 with the Warrior. It's the best I've seen Hogan look in years. Sherry played her part. It had a big match feel. It delivered. The crowd, as you say, popped like mad at the end. It's as good as they could have hoped for with the build that they've been given it this last couple of months. I thought they did an excellent job.
Chris?
As Del was just saying, they lived up to the hype. This really could have quite easily not delivered. As we know, with the pre-house show runs that was going to be the WrestleMania 8 main event, they pulled the idea because the house shows weren't any good. This really did deliver with all the hype that it needed. I was surprised that Hogan sold Flair's moves as well as he did and actually wrestled and didn't just do, you know, beat down, point, finger, leg drop, boot, done, like he had for the sort of the back end of that WWF run. They both look in really good condition. Hogan looks healthier, not so huge and roided up.
Yeah, he looks more like an athlete, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's one of those of looking at him, you look at him and you think that's someone that works out in the gym, not someone that's, you know, pumped full of roids and sent to a tanning salon. Because he didn't look as brown as well as he used to. It was the one thing I noticed. it did everything to set Hogan up to be the star that he is as well for his WCW in-ring debut. You know, he got the big win, he got all this stuff in, he made Flair look good at the same time. He showed more wrestling moves than I can remember him doing in his WWF run. So it was a great match, and it was everything that it needed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I can't pick fault in this. You can break it down, and I think everyone gets kind of, you know, 4.5 out of 5. You know, it was, Sherry was fantastic. I mean, it was like every Hulk Hogan match of the 80s in that Hogan got on top and then the manager got involved. I mean, it happened about 4 times, which is kind of testament to the match they told. But she was great. I mean, she's been fantastic ever since paired up with Flair, you know, it happened. Yeah. Kind of, you know, last month. I mean, she had a great bit on WCW Saturday Night, which I'll come to in a bit. But she was great. The crowd were fantastic. The crowd was everything they could have hoped for. And okay, they were into both guys, and it wasn't your kind of Flair getting booed, Hogan getting cheered. It was Flair getting cheered a lot, and Hogan getting cheered a lot more. And that was it. And it was fantastic, and credit to both guys. I think Hogan, Chris, as you say, he looks fresh. And when was the last time you were able to say that about Hulk Hogan? And okay, you can't have, you know, a year off between matches, or maybe you can if he wants to dictate terms like that. But, you know, he can't keep doing that and keep bringing him back. But he looks in really good shape. He looks up for it. And it showed in the match. It looked involved. And I think for him, he wanted the match to be really good. Maybe whereas, you know, 7 or 8 years into his run in the WWF with Flair and all the stuff with Hogan maybe not wanting Flair to steal his limelight, way because the shoe's on the other foot and Hogan kind of needs to borrow a bit from Flair and WCW. His work rate ran up. Flair is great. We know that. I don't need to, you know, bore you to death on that. But Flair kind of knew his role in this match, knew what he had to do. He did it to a T. Hogan looked great. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't a fantastic wrestling match, but it was never going to be a fantastic wrestling match. The point was that if you'd have set the bar as good a match as you could have got between these two, it would have smashed it. And that's all you can ask for. And it made Hogan feel like a star, and that was always the concern. It's the concern I've had for the last few months, was that what if it doesn't go wrong? What if Hogan gets booed in his big match? Okay, he got booed last month, but that was at the Clash when he was just kind of viewing from the sidelines. Now he was in it. This was kind of night one for Hogan as WCW. And it worked. And credit to all involved, you know. And at the end of the match, we had Shaquille presenting with the title. They went backstage, and Hogan almost had kind of a press conference. Well, it wasn't really a press conference. He kind of just had an interview with Mean Gene Okerlund kind of somewhere in a bar backstage. And there was kind of, Jim Duggan was wandering around. I think Brian Pillman was there. Eric Bischoff got some camera time. Jimmy Hart, obviously, Brutus the Barber, Beefcake, all of those guys. Guardian Angel might have shown up as well. Kind of a lot of the big baby faces, essentially. And Hogan basically said, you know, I'm here now and it's my job to, you know, take on all comers, et cetera, et cetera. Chris, your overall thoughts on this show and a star or a score rating?
Overall, it was solid. It was good quality all the way through, other than the two tag matches. It did everything that it needed to do. It made Hogan look impressive. It made the undertitles look good as well in the US and the TV title matches. It's a solid match. I'd give it a definite 4 out of 5.
Well, so 8 out of 10 is what we're going for.
8 out of 10 then. The only thing is now Hogan has got a bar to live up to. After this one, the standard is quite high for what we now expect for Hogan in WCW.
Yeah, I think we'll come on to Hogan's exit strategy in a minute. Del, your thoughts on the show and a score rating?
I'm a bit more donkey, Bob. I've gave it a 6 out of 10. There was some definite 7, even touching 8 matches with the main event, Steamboat and Stunning Steve for me as well. Even just looking at the opening match, as I say, it was a solid starter. You'd Steamboat and Austin in the middle in the main event delivered. As I say, overall, I'd give it 6 out of 10, but going off air with the Hogan Flair match, you could easily be forgiven for marking the show itself a 7 out of 10, as you say, it was a one match show, the one match delivered. They made it feel like the biggest thing in the world, and they delivered it. It was model professionalism for the both of them. So for what you were expecting going in, I don't think anybody's going to be remembering in 10, 20 years the mid-card fights with the tag team matches. You're going to be looking at Hogan Flair. Hogan, as you say, really won first night official in the company, and they definitely done what they needed to do.
No, I think back in December when we had Starrcade, which was the one match show where Flair was beating Vader for the title, I gave that a 9. I'm going to give this a 9 as well. It wasn't a 3-hour 9 show, but it was a show which was a one match show. Everything before it was just meant to be entertaining enough, noteworthy enough, where people didn't completely switch off. Now that I've talked myself into believing that maybe the tag match was bad by design, I've kind of even gone less down on that. But the main event was great. And it's one of those things where if the crowd are into it, I can almost let a lot of things off. But there wasn't a lot even to let off. But the crowd were fantastic. Everyone did their job to perfection. Hogan worked hard. Flair worked even harder. Sherry did her role. And we ended with a tremendous main event. And as you say, Delph, this is the bit, this was the important part, and it delivered. Yeah. And so for me, I kind of go back to my Starrcade rating, which was the main event ticked every box it could possibly tick. And so that makes it a great show. It's the bit everyone remembers. Chris, as you kind of alluded to in your review, we've got to, I think, look briefly at least at where Hogan goes next. I mean, Flair, on Saturday night, one of the Saturday nights after the show, basically said, you know, I want my rematch, but I don't know when that rematch is going to take place. Next month is the Clash of the Champions. I think they're going to be involved in a match. I've got a feeling it might be a three-way with Vader at the moment, I think, is where they're planning on taking it. And obviously that's a Clash of the Champions, so that might not even be a title match. That might just be kind of a, I don't know. But that's there. Month after that is Full Brawl, which is going to be a War Games match. I presume they're going to go with Colonel Robert Parker's stable, because obviously you could possibly do something like Team Hogan and Team Flair if you want to do something like that. And then all of a sudden it's October, and that seems like quite a long gap to try and do a rematch. Chris, are they better off maybe trying to weave different paths and have them meet up again at Starrcade in December?
I personally would leave it till Starrcade. Because you don't want Hogan having title matches on The Clash, because it takes a little bit of the specialness of having Hogan.
Yeah, and I know. Well, they had a title match on The Clash last month, so it's probably not that. But yeah, I think you're right.
It's just because obviously, if you use Hogan sparingly at first, he is more special, and you don't need to have him on every TV. You don't need to have him at The Clash, but have him in a tag match, which builds to the next pay-per-view, the next big show. So you could use The Clash as a start point to do something with Flair. Say, have Flair and Anderson sort of do a little horseman-y sort of thing against Hogan and one of his mates, maybe the Guardian Angel, Briefcake, you know.
Jim Duggan, whoever.
Yeah, you know. And so they're together, they're working together still, but so they're still sort of fresh in the mind, but leave it to get a decent enough build-up again.
I don't know how you're going to do that for 6 months if you want to wait till Starrcade, though. I almost wonder where you've almost kind of got to detach it and then build it back up rather than, because I think if you try and keep them on a path for 6 months, it might have burnt out by December.
That's that. I mean, even looking at this one, Bob, how quick did they build this up? It was the biggest match we've ever seen. You're talking, what, 4-6 weeks of a build between
Hogan
and Flair.
Well, it depends how you want to define it. I mean, they've been building, well, okay, the news in with the newsletters kind of began in February. They first started mentioning it around the time when Flair faced Steamboat, I think back in April, was when they were running the Hogan kind of stuff with Thunder and Paradise. And they kept asking, I guess it worked for this, but they still have those things where they'd ask Ric Flair 6 questions in an interview with me and Gene Okerlund.
Mm.
2 weeks ahead of his match with Ricky Steamboat, and 5 of them were about Hogan, and 1 of them was about Steamboat. And so they've It's been brewing for longer, but you're right. Hogan only signed at the beginning of June, and they only really had a kind of... It was only really the Clash where that was their big flashpoint to build it all up.
That's that TV build at such a short time. And then looking back to the news that we got last month with the contract situation, if you're talking $300,000 a show as well, they've got to watch what they're doing with that build, even just to try and make money off it at the same time.
Yeah. Although equally, I guess if they're going to pay him that much minimum plus whatever he does on top of the average, then they've got to try and make every show he does a big one.
Exactly.
Chris, beyond Flair, are there a ton of opponents for Hogan? I mean, I mentioned Vader earlier, but it's not like the heel side of that roster is stacked. I mean, you want to look down this card and it's, what is it, Steve Austin, would you say, third in line? Maybe Arn Anderson if you want to go there. Maybe Terry Funk if you want to have Funk in. But I don't think Funk is a guy who wants to lose in a big match, because I think he'd rather protect his own kind of brand rather than have a big payday and lose a match. Is there a big list of opponents you can line up for Hogan?
Don't really think there is at the minute. As you say, there's Vader, maybe Steve Austin.
I think it's too soon for Steve Austin, though.
Yeah, it's the thing, you send, because you know that if Hogan goes against Austin, Austin is going to lose. It's one of those of you'll see the result before it gets there. And is that actually in the end going to be just bury Austin more, which makes him less relevant?
It's probably not going to help either of them, because it'll be a step too far for Austin, it'll be a step down for Hogan. And then Hogan wins, and again, we're talking about trying to sell pay-per-views. I don't think the kind of run Austin has had in the last year, you kind of rocket him into a main event with Hogan in 3 months' time. I don't think that's going to do much business.
No. The only other option is maybe put him against some of the faces. Put him against a Sting.
Yeah.
Because no one's seen that match before.
No.
Steamboat, maybe, because Steamboat was good enough to have the title, one of the world titles, not long ago. So I think with how WCW's looking at the minute, I worried that you couldn't just have him against whoever's the generic heel. I think you could do maybe put him against the faces of WCW.
Yeah.
As a different option, because looking at the heel side, it's slim pickings.
Del, any more thoughts?
That's that. The only worry, as you say, is long term. It's... You've got, obviously, an inevitable rematch with Flair that he's talking up. You've got Vader there. After that, as you say, I think you're maybe going to have to go with the chance of maybe selling it on a never-before-seen. So, as Chris says, maybe your Stings, kind of, it's going to be a difficult one to book. Maybe they can be a bit creative with that over the next couple of months to build that up. But I think that's going to be what they're inevitably faced with, selling it on a never-before-seen basis.
Yeah, I mean... Hogan, we know, has a contract through to December. I don't, beyond that, it's kind of up in the air. I guess it depends on him. It depends on his Hollywood commitments. It depends on how well he's drawing, all of the above. And so I think you've got to prepare in mind that December might be it. I mean, by that point, mate, because the idea with Hogan isn't, I don't believe, is to have Hogan still be the guy in 2-3 years' time. I think it's, let's bring him in, get as much as we can out of him while he's still relevant, and hope that he can put more eyeballs onto the other guys that can take them forward in 3-4 years' time.
So
6 months might be it. And so in that case, I guess it becomes then, well, okay, we've got 4 more pay-per-views, September, October, November, December. Yeah, there's not one next month, but I think November. Yeah, I guess if they want to do... oh God, what was it called last? I forget what it was even called now. The pay-per-view with all the tag title tournament and the main event for the ring. Whatever that was called. Horrible show last year. They do that again. They'll have a show in October. But yeah, if not, then it's 3 pay-per-view main events. And then I guess it's Vader, Sting, Flair. And that's 3 big matches.
The thing is, if you look at Full Brawl, would you put Hogan in the War Games, or would you leave him out of that to have a singles match?
I guess it depends on... I think if I was going to try and make Flair Hogan go every month between now and December, which I think would be a mistake, I guess that would be, let's do almost Team Flair and Team Hogan, as you say, Chris, kind of keep them involved but not have them in singles title matches. If not, do you have to end with War Games? I guess
it is the marquee match of the event. It's the thing that makes Full Brawl what it is.
You're right. Well, I guess then maybe there's the thing to say, well, if that's going to be the big selling point of the show, you can almost not hide Hogan away, but you could do Hogan in the co-main. But would Hogan, second pay-per-view in, really want to be in the second from the top match? I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're thinking we need to get Vader in October, Flair in December, we need to get him through one match, that is the show where you can almost tuck him in with an Austin, maybe. Maybe that's the place to do it. But you're right, it's not easy, and who knows what they're thinking. If Hogan's had this big match and gone, I want to do more than 6 months, then I guess the yardstick changes. Maybe you don't want to do Flair for a long time. But I think we'll wait and see, and we'll see how Four Brawl shapes up. Right, we'll jump into the television review for the month. A couple of notes on TV reviews. Firstly, given all the work I've been doing with the steroid trial, I haven't actually seen all of the TV. So much I haven't actually seen any ECW this month, so something I had to give. So next month we're going to have a double load of ECW news. But WCW TV review. Hulk Hogan was shown training for his match with Ric Flair with boxer George Foreman. On the 9th of June edition of WCW Saturday Night, there was an experimental live edition of the show. It was Hogan's first appearance at the Orlando studio directly, and apparently it was so popular, and this is a good sign for Hogan, they had to turn away 2,000 people. Bear in mind, they usually have to paper that because they're trying to do kind of, you know, four tapings in a day, you know, in the afternoon, wrestling fans out there. But Hogan turned up and 2,000 people were turned away from the 800-seat venue. Fans are voting on the 900 line to push for either Vader versus the Guardian Angel or Ric Flair versus Sting as the main event. No real shock they went with Flair and Sting. The main event only got 7 minutes, and Sherry, dressed as a man, interfered. Injured Sting, who was taken off during the with a storyline eye injury, as I mentioned earlier. Hogan came in and made the save, did an atomic drop to the, Sherry, dressed as a bloke. She then revealed she was a woman, and Flair dragged her away. And after the Bash pay-per-view, Ric Flair said he was working on getting a rematch with Hulk Hogan. He said Hogan was on top of the world now, and that he had really surprised him at the pay-per-view. Moving on to the WWF TV review, Bret Hart and the 1-2-3 Kid had a very good television match for the WWF title on the 7th of June edition of Raw. Match lasted 22 minutes and was the first call of Jim Ross, who I must admit was a breath of fresh air on commentary. I think Monsoon is, you know, as they say, I think Monsoon is maybe a bit over the hill, and Vince McMahon just doesn't know any of the moves. Ross has a fresh sound, and he, as I say, you can call the moves. Wade Keller gave this match a 4-star rating. Really good match, undoubtedly, although you'd expect that from the Kid and Bret Hart. The only real criticism I had was what the hell the Kid had done to justify a WWF title match in the first place, but I guess we'll ignore that. And Ted DiBiase, courting the services of Lex Luger to join his stable. Kind of brewing. Like, Luger at one point came out for an interview on Superstars indicating that he had joined Ted DiBiase and said that I haven't sold out to Tatanka, who's also involved in this feud. Tatanka said, I can do the job. So DiBiase said, I'll give you $10,000 if you can beat Nikolai Volkov, which he did. And there was a promo on this, which we're now going to listen to, which will recap this feud slightly.
Debatable.
Pay him his money, you owe him $10,000.
This is going to be great. Give him the money.
Never let it be said that the $1 million man is not a man of his word. You're going to find out right now. Pay him his money. Pay him his money. $10,000, Tatanka. Now, I never said that I didn't think you were a great athlete. You are. As a matter of fact, I have to admit that I was pretty impressed tonight. As a matter of fact, maybe you even earned this money. You know?
He's up to something.
What you did here tonight to Nikolai Volkov, you could never, ever in your wildest dream or on your best day do that to my Lex Luger.
My Lex Luger?
Save your money, kid.
Hey, million-dollar man Ted DiBiase, I can beat your Lex Luger on my worst day.
You think that you can beat Lex Luger? You think you can beat my Lex Luger? Your ego is that big that you think you can beat Lex Luger? Well,
here comes Lex. Here comes Luger.
I'll tell you something, Conklin. If you think you can beat Lex Luger, why don't you tell him yourself? Why don't you challenge him right now? Because here he comes.
Where's DiBiase going? This is the second time we've seen Luger tonight. The first time he was adamant that he had not sold out to the million-dollar man.
Mr. Tonka, obviously you have a problem with me. Are you challenging me? Do you really think you can beat me? Is that what you're saying?
Lex Luger, that's what I'm definitely saying. I can beat you anytime, any place.
You name the time and the place, I'll be there.
Sounds like we got a match.
I don't understand this. I saw Luger and DiBiase gaining eye contact. Now somebody's got to tell me what is going on here. What is going on here?
You heard him. You got the match you wanted. Anytime, any place, you want my Lex Luger, you just let me know.
And I guess, gents, the discussion point this month from the WWF and the TV reviews is The Undertaker versus The Undertaker. Now, before I mention this, you might think, well, where's the Bret and Owen stuff? There hasn't really been any. We had a Jim the Anvil Neidhart squash match. I think they're going to build that in the next few weeks into August for their big match. Well, they must have. But The Undertaker versus The Undertaker. Now, to fill in what happens, and we covered this in the news slightly, they've been slowly building. You know, on TV it is presented that the fake Undertaker, Brian Lee, is the real Undertaker. At the moment there's only one, we haven't seen the second. There's been no real mention of there being a second. And so much so that we had a segment on TV a couple of weeks back where the fake Undertaker won a squash match and Ted DiBiase was, you know, lauding him. Out, Paul Bearer came and tried to, I can't remember if he had the urn or not, but he was trying to pull the Undertaker back to the good side. So obviously Paul Bearer at least still believes that this is the real Undertaker. Now, Ted DiBiase got some money out and was able to turn the fake Taker's, you know, to keep him on his side. But then I don't think it was the same week or it was the week after we had the kind of the SummerSlam bit with Todd Pettengill. And Todd Pettengill says, we're going to get Undertaker versus Undertaker in the main event.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, what? All right, I know. I know. But. And I appreciate that for them, they want to announce the main event as early as possible to get people hyped so they can do the posters, so they can get all the promotion work done, etc., etc. But now they haven't told this story.
Pretty much. They might have shifted tickets. They're going to make it the novelty. This guy versus the same guy. Might want to actually tell people that, yep, there's two of them. As you say, so far we've seen Paul Bearer, who, if you kind of read between the lines in that, at the end of that match, you might be able to deduce that he thinks that's not my Undertaker. I'm going to go get my Undertaker. But come on, give us a chance. Actually, let us know this is a fake Undertaker. Ted DiBiase's got him. The real dead man's coming back and they're going to have a match. We've still not had any of that and they're selling tickets for it.
Chris?
It's a weird one because, as you're saying, on TV, they're still trying to say that there's the only one Undertaker and Paul Bearer's trying to bring him back to the dark side as such and not the money side. If they wanted to announce something, I'm surprised they just didn't announce Owen and Bret and sort of, cause that's, sort of the match you could put on the poster to start with. Why they need to say that there's going to be Undertaker versus Undertaker, yet not bring it up on TV and explain it, just really sort of baffles the mind of how they're going to get out of it, because now they need to explain it in a way that, you know, we've already told you this too.
Yeah, it feels like they spoil a movie at the start and then, right, good luck, you've got to be entertained for the next hour while we tell you exactly how we got there. That's not storytelling. And for me, that's a strange one. I mean, yeah, I've seen the posters, so, you know, okay, there's reasons for doing it, but, Dan, is this going to be the main event? Is that where we're going?
It's kind of looking worryingly as if it might be. You've got to wonder, I mean, whether it's a case that they're maybe sidetracked with the goings-on outside the ring, which is understandable to an extent with the trial and everything. It seems as if they have missed the opportunity for a lot of money. If it's going to be booked as a main event, imagine that the money and the drive for tickets that you would have when that inevitable reveal came, and it was The Undertaker in the ring, Ted DiBiase. Next thing you know, you've maybe got, say for talking sake, a Paul Bearer comes out for the curtain, Undertaker's with him. That kind of reveal would sell the match itself. It's as if they kind of see the money and the novelty of Taker. But then they've kind of forgot to tell anybody the story behind it. And looking at what you could be seeing across the card with the two hearts, with Bret and Owen going for it, you've got the added bonus for WrestleMania with it being for the belt. You've got the added bonus of it being a steel cage. They've been building up. Owen is obviously the king of the ring. You've got Bret with the belt. It's a money match, but it seems as if it is going to be taking a back seat, unfortunately.
Chris, we've only seen one squash match from the fake Taker, but how does a Taker versus Taker match play out on pay-per-view? Because the fake Taker is dressed as a very convincing version of the real Taker. So if they look exactly the same, that's going to be a really, as Del says, as a novelty it might sell, but as a match, I don't think it's going to work.
No, it to me sounds a little bit like Mirror Mode on Mortal Kombat, where you have the same character in the same outfit and you hope to remember which side of the screen you were on.
That is an amazing analogy. Oh, you're right.
Outstanding.
If they're both going to be the same, it's like, I do like the fact that they've given fake Taker the correct tattoos and stuff to make him look the same as real Taker. But at this point, unless real Taker's going to come out in some new garb, maybe, to be different, or it will just be like looking at it going, hang on a minute, which one's which?
And that's the level of excitement that you've got, that 30 seconds when people sit back and all looking at it. The only issue is you've then got a 10, 12, 15 minute match to follow.
It's the thing, I can't see it being a long drawn-out match.
I mean, far be it from me to compare a main event of SummerSlam to a house show ECW match from about 8-9 months ago. But we've covered this type of match before. I think it was the Patriots had a match, I think, both in masks. And the only difference I seem to remember Colin was pointing out their tassels being different. And okay, yeah. An odd thing to pull up at this point in time, given that there's not much other connection. But that is an instance of a match where two guys dress exactly the same. And I remember it being a snoozer, because you couldn't tell what was going on. It was difficult to tell a story. The crowd didn't know who to cheer or who to get behind. And I guess you could debut kind of a slightly different look to the new Taker. Maybe they want to evolve his look slightly, so that's the kind of story that we're going to pivot off this with, a kind of a slightly different angle on the Taker. But if you're going to dress them exactly the same, and that seems to be what they're trying to do, that seems a strange one to me. But I guess we'll see next month how it plays out. Dale, on a slightly different note, although on the same tact, Bret Hart will go into his second pay-per-view as champion, and he might not main event again.
Pretty much, that's the worry. You kind of look back to WrestleMania, you've got the Mockingbird out there, they're lifting him up on the shoulders, you've got Vince sitting at the desk, stands up, gives him the standing ovation, an unannounced standing ovation, sorry Gene. But you've then got, he's no headlining, you've got a, quite frankly, a novelty gimmick match, potentially headlining. Is it going to be the new generation that we're talking about? Or is it a case where they're maybe kind of doing a stop-start on that? We'll maybe see now that Vince is obviously going to be coming back to the office. He's not going to be getting locked up, which might kind of set a bit of set a bit of a driver on what they're actually doing for SummerSlam now, but you do need to worry about Brett. The matches he's throwing out are anything but low quality. I mean, looking back, as you said in the TV review with the match with the 1-2-3 kid, that was a pretty tricky situation for him, going against a face. The crowd wanted to be with the kid. You see the underdog story, and he pulled it out. He got it off Keller with the four star match. But it is worrying for the legacy that Brett's trying to create, and he's worked hard for it. You've just got to hopefully trust in them that they do the right thing.
Chris, we're having this match inside a cage, presumably with the storyline being with Jim, so Jim Neidhart can't get involved. They have the potential though to steal the show like they didn't do at WrestleMania, because just Razor and Shawn ended up doing such a good job with the ladders. But those two, we know how good they are, put them inside a cage, they could have a really good match.
It has potential that it could be match of the year. But them two together, they could do anything. It's a case of, obviously, I get the point of this cage is clearly going to be to stop people interfering. Because obviously you've got the Anvil, obviously with Owen, and the amount of brothers in the family, it'd be quite easy for them to just pick one of them to be on Brett's corner. You know, they might bring Bruce or Keith out. So yeah, having the cage as a way to just leave it as them two, and that to be the focal point, I think it has got a classic written over it. It could potentially be a match of the year.
Yeah, I guess there's also the external threat of Diesel and Shawn Michaels as well, who seem to have taken a sidetrack for the time being at least, but I get the sense Diesel's going to be back in the title picture sooner rather than later, you would think. We're going to do our match/moment of the month. Del, you first, your match or moment of the month.
It was a pretty close one, mate. It's been the big pay-per-view, but there wasn't a lot for me to choose with the WCW card bar. Obviously, the main event was a main one, but for me, the match of the month, it might be a bit left field, but I just loved the Bret Hart 1-2-3 Kid Raw match. I thought it was brilliant. They've been giving it a couple of weeks build on the show. It felt big with them starting off with that. As you say, Jim Ross being back on the mic's just a pleasure to hear compared to what we did with God Love Him Gorilla Monsoon. I think he's lost a lot since Bobby Heenan left to WCW. You kind of miss their rapport with each other. Vince is obviously there. He's kind of got a good voice. I quite like him, but it is, at the end of the day, what a manoeuvre and unbelievable.
I should jump in, sorry, quickly. Just Vince McMahon didn't appear on television at all this month.
Yeah, understandably.
Yes.
But as I say, the match itself, Jim Ross sold it with the commentary. They gave it a big build-up. Was it as good as a four-star match? Was it as good as Jim Ross trying to sell it as the best match he's ever seen? I don't think so, but it did what it needed. I thought it was a really good match, really innovative bit in the middle as well. For anybody that didn't see it, was the false finish where Brett's basically got the 1-2-3 Kid, pins him, 1-2-3 bell rings, but Kid's foot was on the rope. Brett, the stellar face of the company, then says, listen, 1-2-3 Kid never get beat there. His foot was on the rope, they restart it. Just thought it was a really good technical match with the understandable aerial prowess of Kid in there as well. Thought they did brilliant with the time they were given.
Chris.
It's tough because part of me says I should give it to Hogan winning the title, but I'm going to go with Steamboat and Austin.
Good man.
Just that match was a clinic in how to have a solid back and forth wrestling match. And the heel ending of, you know, winning with your feet on the ropes. It just had everything that I love about wrestling in one match. You know, Austin grabbing Steamboat's hand and waving to the camera, you know, the cheeky heel who also cheats to win, the good guy that can turn the pace and get the match going, the good guy heel where he wouldn't throw him over the top rope so he wouldn't get disqualified. it just had everything for me, that sort of everything that's good about wrestling in one match.
Well, colour me surprised that I am the only person saying Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan for match of the month.
That's why you're the face of that show, Bob.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, okay, I wasn't blown away by the Austin Steamboat match, but I can appreciate why other people like it. The Once a Dream Kid Bret Hart match for me was almost kind of the opposite end of the, not in terms of it was awful, but in terms of on the kind of pendulum of what makes a great match. This was a really good match with like zero build up, zero heat. Crowd were into it, but in a way it's like face versus face, although so to a degree was Hogan and Flair. But for me, Hogan and Flair was big star versus big star. Okay, it wasn't a great wrestling match, but it was really, really good. Everyone played their part. It was a big fight feel. Crowd were just so into it. And I'm a little bit surprised and a little bit disappointed in you two for overlooking that as your match of the month. You're entitled to your own opinions, so I'm good. Thank you to Del Muir.
Thanks, Bob.
Del, you were on Twitter where?
I am, mate. It's just Del_Muir, DEL_MUIR.
And Chris.
I'm on Twitter at Lacey, LACEY555666.
You've got a podcast, haven't you, Chris, as well?
Yes, we just recorded episode 2 yesterday. It's called The Bottom Line Podcast. It's on iTunes. Our Twitter is Bottom Line Pod. All the links are on there. We basically just do monthly pay-per-view reviews of modern day product and any major stories that come out of the Raw the night after.
Very cool. You can find this project on Twitter at Wrestling20YRS, on our website at Wrestling20Years.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Boy Bamba for modern day wrestling musings. And that is it for this month's July 1994 edition of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. Until next time, goodbye.